The Guardian.
When Dan Hooper was growing up in rural Minnesota, science was not something that ranked highly on his list of likely careers.
Nothing about it seemed exciting. When I did encounter science, I encountered, physics classrooms where we were rolling things down inclined planes and things like this. And if science was presented as anything at all, it was as a useful tool to, build better car engines or computers or something like this.
That was until college, where he wound up taking a course in modern physics.
That's the kind of the turning point in my life. I learned about Einstein's theory of relativity. I learned about quantum phenomena. And these were the single most exciting things I'd ever heard about in my life. And I don't just mean in science or in a classroom. I mean anywhere in life. And to this day, that's true.
Now a theoretical astrophysicist at the Fermi National Laboratory and professor of astronomy and astrophysics at the University of Chicago, Dan has spent his career working on some of the most fundamental questions about our universe. He is particularly interested in those first fleeting moments that followed the Big Bang, a time that even our most advanced telescopes cannot see back to.
At this stage, all of space was filled with a hot plasma of things like quarks and gluons and electrons and Higgs bosons and all these things, all interacting in a dense soup of particles.
All that coming up on Science Weekly.
Just make all these puzzle pieces fit neatly together and wrap up with a nice bow on top.
And that would be the end of physics.
I don't know if there'll ever be an end of physics, but...
I invited Dan into the studio to talk about his new book, At the Edge of Time, and to explain his work at Fermilab, the US's premier particle physics laboratory near Chicago.
Most of the physicists at Fermilab build and operate experiments. I'm not that kind of physicist. I'm a theoretical physicist, which means most of the work I do is on a pencil and paper, a chalkboard, or sometimes on my laptop writing code. I focus on the interface between particle physics and astronomy or astrophysics. So that means I think about things like what the dark matter of our universe might be made of. More or less, I try to figure out how our universe works and how it came to be the way it is.
And in your new book, you look at the first few seconds of the universe, essentially. Why pick that fragment of time?
I pick that piece of time because it's the one we know the least about. We know an awful lot about how our universe has evolved from the first few seconds or minutes forward. So the farther we go back in cosmic history, the less confident we are in statements we can make. I can tell you what the universe was like to a pretty high degree of precision a few hundred thousand years after the Big Bang. I'm as sure of what I'm going to say about that part of our universe's history as I am that there was an American Civil War in the 1860s. We have a lot of ways of observing things that confirm our theories. Frankly, we'd be very surprised if we got that part of our universe's history substantively wrong. But the first few seconds, we don't know a whole lot about that. We don't have any way of observing that period of time. We can learn things about that period of time by studying the laws of physics that dictated that era using particle accelerators. And that makes it much more interesting for people like me to talk about and study.
The Big Bang Theory talks about the universe being this very tiny, hot, dense speck at the origins, at the beginning of time, I guess. Is it possible for physicists to speculate on what gave rise to those starting conditions? How did that come to be?
We do speculate about these things, and how good we are at speculating about it is a matter of some debate. Space is expanding. We know that, and that means that in the past, any particular volume of space was smaller than it is today, and hotter and denser. But I wouldn't necessarily say that we know that our early universe was small. It could be that space is infinite. We don't know. So when you're talking about something as big as infinity, we have to be relatively humble about how that came to be and how things started out and why and how that all fits into the big picture.
If we're talking about the Big Bang as people generally understand it, what happens when we set the timer running in that first half a second, quarter of a second or something? What triggers the Big Bang and, what really is that?
So the way that people thought about the Big Bang, a few decades ago, they would say, well, if I take the equations that Einstein wrote down back in the 19-teens and run them backwards, people like Stephen Hawking and Roger Penrose and others showed that you'd eventually reach a point in time where we run into something called a singularity. This is the moment itself of the Big Bang, T equals zero, if you will. And not only does space come into existence at T equals zero, but so does time. And if there was no time, there could have been no events. So you can't talk about what could have caused the Big Bang or anything like that. So asking what happened prior to the Big Bang is like asking how you go north of the North Pole. There's no direction you can go from the North Pole that gets you farther north. It is a singular point on the globe.
What happened before the Big Bang might be a philosophically challenging and perhaps even nonsensical question, and even the first moments afterwards are beyond the reach of modern science. But with observations we make today and experiments in particle colliders, we can build models of the universe's evolution and run them backwards and get close to T equals zero. Turn the clock back far enough and the universe becomes a hot, dense ball of energy 13.8 billion years ago.
The farthest the particle accelerators we have at present allow us to go back is to about a trillionth of a second after the Big Bang. At this stage, all of space was filled with a hot plasma of things like quarks and gluons and electrons and Higgs bosons and all these things, all interacting in a dense soup of particles. As the universe expanded and cooled, you reach a point where those quarks begin to bind together to make the first protons and neutrons. At this point, we're talking about a temperature of something like 100 billion degrees. And then a few seconds later, those protons and neutrons begin to bind together to make the first nuclei. And then as you go on further, you reach a point a few hundred thousand years after the Big Bang, where electrons begin to bind to those nuclei, making real atoms for the first time. Now, this is a really important transition because around this time, the universe becomes transparent to light. Before there were atoms, sending light through space would have been about as difficult as shining a beam of light through the Earth. You just won't get very far. But as these neutral atoms formed, space became transparent and light was released into all of space. And we still observe that light today. We can measure it quite precisely. We call it the cosmic microwave background. Universe continued to expand. By the time that the cosmic microwave background is forming, most of the energy in the universe was formed of matter for the first time. This is mostly dark matter, but also atoms. And then those forms of matter begin to collapse, forming things like galaxies and eventually clusters of galaxies and stars and planets and all the rest. A few billion years ago, dark energy became the predominant source of energy in our universe, outweighing the amount of energy stored up in matter. And that's causing our universe to expand faster and faster as time goes on.
Expand on that a little bit more. I mean, what sort of things could you look for to try and get some idea of detail of what was actually happening way back then?
So when we look at those microwaves that came from the first few hundred thousand years, we study the detailed patterns of light across the sky. And we find that some parts of the sky are slightly hotter or colder than each other. I'm talking about one part in 100,000 times hotter or colder than other parts. And that gives us essentially a map of how energy and matter were distributed throughout space at that moment in time, 380,000 years after the Big Bang. So the first few hundred thousand years of our universe was opaque to light. So we can't use light to study that window of time. Presently, the only thing we have to look back farther directly are the light nuclei that were formed through nuclear fusion in those first seconds and minutes. So those survive and we can measure them and study them in the same way that an archaeologist might, you know, dig up pottery from some ancient civilization to learn what life was like at that time. We look at these light nuclear elements as a relic of the first minutes and seconds. We have other ideas of things we could study one day to teach us about the first moments of our universe's history, but we don't have the technology to detect them yet. One thing is that around the first second after the Big Bang, we think that the particles we call neutrinos would have been released from the thermal bath of particles, and there would be today something called a cosmic neutrino background, which in principle we could study and measure. We can tell it's there from its gravity. We're sure those particles are there. But maybe sometime many decades from now, we'll be measuring the detailed characteristics of that cosmic neutrino background, learning about that first second in the way that we presently use the cosmic microwave background to learn about the first few 100,000 years.
That's it for part one. After the break, we'll be hearing more about dark matter and dark energy, mysteries that make up the majority of our universe, but which we know almost nothing about.
Bookmarked an article but never returned to read it? You're not alone. With The Guardian's Audio Long Reads podcast, you can listen to expert writing on a diverse range of issues whenever suits you. From immigration...
At each appeal, she was refused the right to stay in the country.
...to cult novelists.
He could not avoid writing murder on his list of options.
For long-form journalism without all the reading, listen to The Guardian's Audio Long Reads on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back. After observing the cosmic microwave background, the relic radiation that is considered to be the ancient afterglow of the Big Bang, cosmologists had good evidence that the universe had grown from a hot, compact ball through a period of rapid inflation, followed by more gentle expansion. For decades, cosmologists generally thought that in the modern universe, the expansion rate should be slowing down. But in the 1990s came a surprise. Observations appeared to show that it was doing exactly the opposite. The rate of expansion was speeding up. This left them with a new mystery.
When it comes to dark energy, what we really know is that our universe is expanding faster, and something has to make that happen. We kind of use the phrase dark energy as a placeholder for that something. It could be, and probably is, the thing that most physicists think is likely, is that all of space contains a fixed energy density in it, like as an intrinsic property. So if I take a cubic meter of space at any point in our universe, any place in our universe, and at any point in cosmic history, in addition to energy stored in stuff like particles or light that it contains, in addition to that, there's a fixed energy density cooked into it. And then as the universe expands and everything else gets diluted by that expansion, dark energy starts to be more important because it doesn't get diluted. As space expands, you just get more dark energy. So that's why it's taking over in the last few billion years. But it's also possible that those equations that Einstein wrote down back in 1915 aren't complete. And if we really understood a more sophisticated or deeper or more fundamental theory of gravity, we would understand why space is behaving in this way, and maybe we rename dark energy as some sort of understanding of gravity or space-time.
Is it the same, well, a similar case with dark matter, that it's a holding phrase, or is dark matter actually a pretty different prospect, that actually you know that it is something with mass and so on, you just cannot see it because it doesn't radiate?
So in some sense, the phrase dark matter is just a placeholder for our ignorance. We don't know what dark matter is made up of. But unlike dark energy, I'm pretty confident that dark matter is a form of matter and it really exists. And one day we'll measure the characteristics of the particles that make it up. Now, back in the 1980s, people proposed theories in which there was no dark matter. It was just a misunderstanding of the laws of gravity. But those theories haven't been very successful. And as we've measured more and more lines of evidence in favor of dark matter, it's become harder and harder to explain away those observations with various kinds of alternative gravity theories. So at this point, I'm 99-point-something percent confident that dark matter really exists. That being said, we are not anywhere near confident that we understand what it consists of.
And why is it that, do you think, that physicists are having such a hard time detecting dark matter particles?
Let me turn the question around on you, okay? I'll do a little bit of jujitsu here and say, why is it that it's so easy to detect other kinds of particles? So we know electrons exist because they carry electric charge. And that means they interact through the electromagnetic force. And that's a strong enough force that allows us to do any number of measurements to detect the presence of the electron. If electrons didn't have a electric charge, they could pass through solid objects without any effort. They would be like ghosts. They would essentially not interact with the world around them. Similarly, protons and neutrons interact through the strong nuclear force. This is a very easy force to measure and detect. You know, so basically, we have a list of particles that interact through the known forces, and that's how we study them. Now, if we imagine that there's some other kinds of particles, one or more, that don't have things like electric charge and don't interact through the strong nuclear force, these are particles that we would have a much more difficult time identifying. Now, we'd still feel their gravity, like we feel the gravity of dark matter, but we wouldn't be able to measure their other characteristics in any straightforward way. The hope is that these particles will interact in some feeble way, some non-negligible but still quite feeble way, and we're building experiments and operating experiments constantly that are more and more sensitive to those hypothetical interactions, building detectors of dark matter in deep underground laboratories and trying to detect the energetic particles that might be released when dark matter particles interact among themselves, and trying to produce dark matter particles in the collisions that take place in particle accelerators.
On the hunt for dark matter, there's one thing in particular that Dan finds especially frustrating.
Scientists don't always talk about things they hate in their chosen field, but in the book, you admit to hating pulsars. To the rest of us, a rotating neutron star is a pretty cool thing. What is it about them that invokes your ire?
A pulsar is at some level a fascinating object, and there are lots of people who study pulsars for a living, and I have no ill will towards those scientists. What a pulsar is a neutron star, which is something with a mass more than the sun squeezed into something the size of a fraction of London. Okay, so a really compact, dense object made mostly of neutrons. And when those stars are formed in supernova explosions, they tend to leave that explosion spinning super rapidly. It's for the same reason that when a figure skater pulls their arms in, they begin to spin faster. When a star collapses, they spin faster as well. You take something that might rotate once every month or something, and now it's rotating more than once a second on its axis. All of that rotational energy gets released into jets of particles or maybe radio waves. And when that beam of radio waves points in your direction, you see a pulse. So that's why we call them pulsars. They flash in this periodic way. All that's so good, but they also happen to produce high energy particles of light, what we call gamma rays, that look a lot like the signal that we predict dark matter particles to create. So every once in a while, we point our telescope somewhere, we see something that looks like a signal of dark matter, and you have to ask yourself, might these really be pulsars faking a dark matter signal? It is the bane of dark matter hunters' existence, such as my own, and I have over time really learned to hate pulsars.
With so many frustrations alongside all the questions and unknowns, I wanted to know whether Dan thought it was a worrying time for the field of cosmology, or if all these mysteries simply opened up exciting new avenues to explore.
The way I look at it is we have a spectacularly successful theory in the Big Bang. It's made many, many predictions, detailed, precise predictions, basically all of which have panned out correctly. But there are a few important puzzles or problems that persist. We still don't know what the dark matter is. We know it's there. It makes up 5/6 of the matter in our universe, but we don't know what it's made of. We know that dark energy exists, but we don't know what it is. What we really see is that our universe's expansion rate is accelerating recently in the last few billion years. Dark energy drives that, but we don't know why or how. Our understanding of physics says that there shouldn't be any matter in our universe. All of the matter should have been destroyed by antimatter in the first fraction of a second, and yet here we are. That's a big puzzle. And also, our universe is strangely uniform. It's basically the same everywhere. And the only way we have to explain that at present is with a theory called inflation, but we don't understand how or why that happened. So these loose ends are, of course, important, and they make it exciting to study that first fraction of a second after the Big Bang. And maybe one day we'll just tie up all those loose ends and make a coherent picture. Or maybe it's telling us that we're thinking about the early universe entirely wrong, and some big revolution in science is coming in this direction.
You talk a lot in the book about scientific revolutions, something Thomas Kuhn argued was the way science really progresses. Do you think cosmology needs a revolution? Do you expect one coming anytime soon?
So Thomas Kuhn would tell you that you can't possibly know that a revolution is about to take place. It's if you could predict that, then the revolution would have already happened. You can't even tell when you're in one, right? You only know looking back on it, like, oh yeah, that was a revolution. So I can't definitively answer that question. That being said, I do think about it a lot. When I'm talking to my colleagues about this, I like to ask them the following question. I say, what do you think it was like to be a physicist in 1904? The reason I picked 1904 is because it's the high point of physicists' confidence in their theory. In 1904, we had a couple hundred years in which Newtonian physics just worked. It solved problem after problem. New stuff would come out and new observations, new measurements, and they'd use the old Newtonian thinking to successfully explain it. It was an amazing period of time. But in 1905, Einstein came out with a couple of very important papers introducing things like quantum physics and relativity that showed that some of the loose ends that were there in 1904 couldn't be addressed within the Newtonian framework. He didn't just expand upon or add to the Newtonian framework. He tore it down and built something in its place. The inner workings of the atom, the way that the sun produced starlight for so long, could not be explained in the Newtonian framework. It needed quantum physics. So these were things that were seen as loose ends at the time, but they required a paradigm-changing revolution. Maybe that's where cosmology is today. Maybe not. I'm cheering for the side of revolution, though. I think that would be exciting to live through.
We'll be keeping our eye out for any potential revolutions here at Science Weekly. Huge thanks to Dan Hooper for joining us. You can find a link to his book, At the Edge of Time, at theguardian.com. If you have any thoughts or feedback, do send us an email at scienceweekly@theguardian.com. This episode was presented by me, Ian Sample, and produced by Madeline Finley.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.